You must be this
the chip is the product.
Right.
So, yeah. It's that one chip. And or the power
no, anybody but you.
See?
I didn't even know.
We were expecting the 9-foot guy.
You give me a check, too.
He's bringing up
the you have to sign.
Oh, we have TSA here to check you.
Do we have critical mass? Or we
yeah, yeah, I think we do.
We have mass.
And we're properly late.
Too much.
We're always that way.
So here we go. Good evening. Welcome. Bob is in Japan. Lucky devil.
No, he just got back. But he's
he just got back. He's seriously jet lagged.
This afternoon.
Yeah, oh.
Yeah, his brain probably hit somewhere over Alaskan Peninsula.
Yeah. Or halfway in a bottle of Kikkoman.
It's a saucy comment.
Anyway, so let's see. So I guess I should just get right with it. AES members, please. Can't raise your hand. 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12. Please remember that.
Who's the oldest AES member, not old in age, who joined in the earliest year? I'm
well,
curious.
Who's got the lowest number?
Oh.
That's the way to do it, because it's all chronological. Okay, what's your number?
Well, I don't know. I'm 1969. That's what I was
1970.
Thinking.
1970. Oh, wow. You guys are ahead of me.
Anybody before 69?
Anybody?
Hey, wow.
No.
Oh.
Anybody with a three-digit number? I guess not.
I know some.
97.
I know somebody with a one-digit number.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow.
Jay McKnight.
He's still alive.
Yeah.
He almost married my aunt. That's a long story.
Okay, so 12. So
does she knit?
No, she married somebody else. 6, 7,
8, 9, 10. 29, including the baby.
Out of how many were AES members?
12 members.
There you go.
Yes.
Okay. Wow. For the record. Let's see. So what else do I need to do?
Sign up the rest.
Sign up the rest?
The ones that aren't members.
Oh, right. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Join the AES.
Yeah. Join. It's a good thing.
Good. Good job.
There's a chest, an audio chest position that's going to be posted on the web tonight or tomorrow. It's from Protingent. We've posted jobs for them before, so if this is something that maybe is up your alley, then check the website. It'll be there.
Sign in.
Oh,
four more.
Four more.
Any of you guys?
33.
And two members.
Two
more members.
So that's 14 members and
33 attendees.
Yes.
Including the baby.
Including right. The baby.
Why would you not include the baby? Because
well, the baby's absorbing
the
all this by osmosis.
Right. And will be the person with the lowest AES membership number.
Yeah, no question. Yeah.
Absolutely.
Got the jump on it.
Yeah. Okay, let's see. I don't have any info on next month's meeting, right? We haven't sorted that yet. Okay.
Is there a reschedule for the February?
Yes, but we haven't sorted it out yet. I guess we could sort it now. Steve, when do you want to do that?
Whenever you guys want it.
Okay. Well, we just have to find a venue. So, could be the friendly local software company. Okay. Well, then, let's just do the meeting.
Go around, right?
Oh, yes. Thank you. Let's do the ring around the audience. So, I'll start, and the object is say your name, say why you're here, what do you do in audio?
Anything interesting that might exist, but short.
Yeah.
Short.
Kind of like posting on Facebook.
Yeah.
Yeah?
You.
I can take it.
Twitter.
I don't tweet.
140 characters.
I need your
tweet. I'm Rick Chin. I'm the webmaster. I'm the vice chair of the section. I have a company called Unita Audio. We do just about anything audio. We don't do video, and we don't do lights, and I don't do glider. JJ.
JJ, Jim Johnston, AES guy, worked on perceptual coding, signal processing, DSP, et cetera, extreme sinus for DTS.
Okay. Steve Turnage, Ultraviolet Studios, Ars Divina. Some news. I just got a contract to do a book on desktop mastering from Hal Leonard.
All right.
That was announced June 1st. Second, there's this interesting guitar cable, nothing exciting, except that it's an audio interface. Elisa's new piece, USB, it comes up as you, which is sort of fascinating. And then there's these practice soft sticks, practice drum, you get the practice pad and the sticks. You can hit them on anything if you're drunk. So those are the interesting things lately.
Does it work on children?
Pardon me?
Does it work on children?
We'll find out.
Hi, I'm Christian Heilman, and I'm an independent audio engineer under the business name of Mixer Guy. So I produce Steve Turnage, and I've been a live audio engineer for a lot of people in town, Teatro Zanzani, Triple Door, Crocodile, and I'm here to learn about cables.
My name is Aaron Gates. I'm adventure traveling rock star overtones cabling guy, and I'll go anywhere in the world and plug it in.
That could be taken a different way.
No, I think you're right.
All right.
Recently returned from India.
I'm Mark Edman. I build high performance speaker systems for home music playback, and my systems are designed specifically to eliminate wacky cables.
I'm Bob Smith. I'm an acoustic researcher for Medtronic Physiocontrol, and I own a small project studio called BS Studios in South Smith Labs.
Steve Wilkins. I have an undergraduate degree in psychophysics. I've worked in acoustics consulting. Been a musician for 30 years, produced 10 or 15 CDs that nobody's ever heard, and just published my fourth book of poems. Which I have for sale.
Mike Medeski, member of the AES PNW program committee, owner of Opus 4 Studios, musician, cellist, studio guy.
I'm Mark Rogers. I'm a consultant in audio, video, and acoustics.
Which way do we go?
I'm Brad Oman. I'm an electrical engineer. My interest is principally casual. I've done a couple DIY headphone amps on the side.
Michael Madalena. I just like to listen to music.
My name is Chris Deckard. I'm a recovering studio alert. But I currently build robots with these guys, actually.
I'm Pete Peters. I work with audio control, mainly with multi-channel power amps, but I do a little bit of work with signal processors and DSP, that sort of thing. And I build test fixtures and develop procedures.
Dave Dintonpass, Full Track Productions, older Ampex tape recorder repair, and technical writing.
Bill Levy, I do location recording. My company's Via Audio, do a lot of local classical music groups, choirs, that kind of stuff.
My name is Bill Williams. I own a company called Lunchbox Audio, primarily like high-end pro audio recording equipment.
Tom Siles, I work at Jack Straw Productions, and I work at Seattle Center Sound Department, and I work other places.
Rick Kernan, the company name is Vanatu, and we develop powered speakers.
I'm Steve Hastings. I am for JJ, and I'm really mostly a software guy, but I want to learn more and more about audio.
I'm Gary Gasolich. I'm a mechanical engineer. I'm Rick's business partner in Vanatu, and I'm kind of the main loudspeaker designer.
Great. I'm Jamie Singer. I work for Broadcast Supply Worldwide, and I get the audio gear to people who need it.
Gary Beebe, also a Broadcast Supply Worldwide in Tacoma. I sell equipment to radio stations.
I'm Lars Nusker, underemployed recording engineer, all around AV tech, 600 albums to my credit, 590 nobody's ever heard of.
Dave Wood, I work for Loud Technologies, Mac, Ampeg, all sorts of things. Do a variety of things, done some DSP and in analog and digital design. Right now I've been doing some tube guitar amps for Ampex.
My name is Scott Marins. I work for Motorola Mobility and I do music effects software and have some noise suppressor for the smartphone stuff.
I'm John Mendenhall. I'm the local Belden rep.
Kevin O'Neill with Flight of Harmony, make analog audio syndicate.
I'm Jonathan with him. I'm the numbers guy.
Thank you.
Hey, I'm Kurt Denke. I don't know what I'm doing here. I used to run a home wine and beer making supply store, and then I was a lawyer, and now I make audio and video cable assemblies. And so if you ever need legal advice in a situation where a police officer beats you senseless while he's drunk on homebrew with a piece of audio cable,
perfect.
That would be the intersection of my skills.
What's the name of that company?
Oh, Blue Jeans Cable.
Did you ever live
in? I'm afraid not.
And I'm Steve Lampin from Belden, and I wander the world schmoozing with engineers and interested people and don't have a real job. Well, I kind of had a real job now, which I'll talk about maybe later. But mostly just schmoozing and writing and speaking.
So I think the format is we're just going to do a Q&A.
Yeah, and unless, I mean, I have some slides behind me here. If everything gets really boring, I can make it even more boring by throwing up some slides and talking about those. But I mean, really, this is kind of an interactive thing of, well, I'll tell you what. I was thinking, here's the perfect story to start it off because everybody will get upset with this story. Okay. The best audio I have ever heard in my life, and you've never even heard this story. The best audio I ever heard in my life, and this was in a garage, of all places, with some really unbelievably gorgeous gear. And it was the first and really only time that I have heard sound coming out of speakers that I couldn't tell really where the sound was coming from. That, you know, I know you talk about soundstage and we talk about this kind of stuff, and it's like, this is the only time I've actually not being able to tell where the sound came from. It was, by the way, it was Magnapans, giant Magnaplaner speakers with these huge power amplifiers running the whole thing. And the most interesting thing, the thing will start you thinking, is that this garage was Noel Lee, the guy who owns Monster Cable. And I thought, wow, this is amazing, that this is the best audio I ever heard is in this guy who I didn't think had two ears to his name, you know? So, that was one experience I thought was quite interesting. However, after that, the point is, I'm not sure that I can tell you anything about wire and cable except for what I can measure in a lab. I mean, I work for a company that's a science-driven company, and we supply him with cable, and he puts it together and sells it, which is just fine, and everybody's happy. We all make money. But other than that, I'm not exactly sure where we're going to go.
You know, we had a call, actually, from a customer this afternoon that is characteristic, maybe, of what this discussion is about. That it was a fella who, he called to talk about power cords. Now, we don't sell power cords for amplifiers because we don't know why we would. You can buy them all over the place. The ones you can buy are great, and they're cheap, and not our forte. But he was adamant, and people are like this. They call us up to argue all the time. And he wanted to let us know that we were all very, very wrong to say that you shouldn't have a fancy power cord on your amp, and that he'd switched out the power cord on his amp for some $500 special, and now the sound was no longer analytical. And that's probably my favorite audiophile cable adjective, because we actually run into it quite a bit. People will say this cable is very analytical and this cable is not at all analytical. And it reminds me of there's an old story about a physicist. I can't remember who the fella is. He reads a journal article at any rate with which he is in complete disagreement, and he shakes his head and he says, "That's not right. In fact, it's not even wrong." And, you know, I would say a lot of what is said about audio cable is not even wrong. It's too ill-defined. It's too ill-defined to question. What makes a cable sound analytical? who even knows what that means?
I'll tell you what makes cable sound analytical: expectation bias.
And expectation bias is one of the things that will make it sound analytical, whatever analytical is. And you know,
if
but
you expect that that's what you hear.
Yeah.
But does it have air?
Does it have air and movement and energy and impetus?
Don't forget slam.
Rhythm and timing.
Oh, absolutely, absolutely, and musicality. But not excessive brightness.
Unless it's barbed wire, that's really sharp.
Yes, that's true. but harsh.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah.
Pointed.
Pointedly harsh.
Yeah.
I got into this business actually was from getting into arguments online with people about power cables, because I had the misfortune of having built a few power supplies and having a pretty good idea what, you know, a transformer and a rectifier and a filter capacitor and a filter choke and a voltage regulator actually did. And what I learned is that in audiophile circles, knowing those things is... it's far from a qualification. It's pretty much a disqualification. Those are the kinds of knowledge which are irrelevant to the subjective experience of cabling as it's understood in that broader marketplace. And it's been interesting for us because what we've tried to do is to bring to the consumer world, which is where we deal primarily, the idea that these things that Steve mentions, the things you can measure, are actually the things that matter. That things like capacitance and inductance and resistance and shield effectiveness and things like that, that these things actually do something. And that for some applications, high frequency applications, characteristic impedance is very important and things of that nature. And it's been an interesting journey because the audiophilia out there it's very thick. And people have a lot of emotional investment in the idea that this cable sounds rich or musical or bright or harsh or something, and they spend, I'm sure you all know, some of them spend $25,000 for a pair of speaker cables, and more, yes.
Audio Quest Ultima, $35,000 for 8 feet.
Yeah.
I've seen more expensive than that.
Oh, yeah.
There were actually vacuum-filled speaker cables once at CES. $10,000 a foot for vacuum cables, and they had little spigots on them. You turn the spigot, then it got filled with air, and you had to send them back to be re-evacuated. So,
yeah. No small expense.
About evacuation comes to mind.
I bet it does.
Can I ask a question? Were
sure.
Were they using audio quality vacuum, or were they using industrial
grade? Oh, that's yeah.
Exactly.
Same. All right.
You'd be a dangerous customer. That's the problem. Yeah. How many millibars are we down to, you know? Exactly.
Well, does that mean after you pump out the air, now you have oxygen-free copper?
No, you have air-free copper.
I know.
And then you have the little tripods that they sell to put the wire on. So
sure. Cable elevators, because you don't want the cable interacting with the floor.
The
that's ground effect. You know
that's ground effect, yes.
Yeah, right.
So, Steve, what's a typical argument you get from somebody who really has a lot of emotional investment in this audio jewelry? No pun intended against your company.
Yeah, right.
But against double-blind testing and science. What's a typical argument you get back?
I heard one very interesting one at dinner tonight, which was, it is so emotional for us to talk about this that by the time you force us into a double-blind test, we're too emotional to be able to judge appropriately.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yep.
And see, part of the problem is this, this gets very close in many ways to religion. Things you believe, things you take on faith, and as you well know, if you start to question religion, this is a very bad thing, and it can only have bad results. And so the people who believe things based on faith don't want them questioned. And it doesn't matter how many charts and graphs and formulas and things I could throw up on the screen, because it's not based on that. It's based on faith. In which case, there's nothing you can say, nothing you can do.
Well, and that's a typical rhetorical strategy. It goes well beyond audio. If you go into scientific investigation of claims of paranormal phenomena, Uri Geller can miraculously bend spoons with his mind, but only if you don't watch him closely enough to figure out whether he's really doing it. If you watch him closely enough to figure out whether he's really bending spoons with his mind, Then all the negative psychic energy in the room overwhelms his great powers, and all of a sudden he's not so able to bend spoons with his mind.
And like when you hand him new spoons that he hasn't prepared.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Now, the interesting thing about this is that there are two ways that people react to that. There's the intellectual way where you look at that and you say, I kind of know what we call a phenomenon which appears when not closely scrutinized and then disappears under scrutiny. We call that something false. But there are a lot of people who are really... They like the idea. They like the idea of the process of subjectivity being so sensitive and so involved and so emotional that it is impossible to rigorously study it. As though we can't rigorously study every other aspect of perception. Nobody thinks we can't rigorously study vision.
Except then they bring up the Heisenberg principle that once you've actually looked at it, you've changed it, and therefore you really can't look at anything. You can't analyze anything because you change it by simply doing it.
Oh, and exactly. If any time anybody says anything about quantum mechanics in connection with cable, you know you're dealing with a shyster. You know, quantum mechanics are all around us.
Well, they also always describe it in subjective terms.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely, absolutely. The fluffier, the
better. Sounds better.
Yeah, exactly.
That.
And that's what I tell people. If they spend $10,000 on a speaker cable, they better hear a difference. For that kind of money, I would expect to hear a difference.
You're
for
buying
sure.
expectations.
Yeah.
I mean, that's if you can afford it.
But see, people spend $1 million on a car. Where are you going to drive that? You know, a Bugatti or something? It's like... But
I'd
say one of the things we were talking about last night, too, was one of the number one reasons people spend this kind of money is bragging rights. I have a $10,000 speaker cable. You know, that really means something to them. And obviously, a lot of us would say, well, that was a total waste of money, but that's not what they think.
I figured out recently I have a $9 million studio.
Yeah, I bet.
No.
Bragging rights, see?
Yeah, but $9 million studio, that's the beauty of it.
Yeah, the point is, so is it any good?
Well,
right?
No,
nobody asks that. So what's it sound like? No. It's $9 million.
No, $9 million.
Oh, $9 million student.
Right, you just slur it a little bit.
Okay. That's Southern. That's
right.
Southern.
It's a $9 million.
Good.
Can I ask a question,
yeah.
Steve?
Yeah, sure.
Who makes Monster Cable?
Oh, lots of people.
I've met a lot of them.
In fact, I went not too long ago to a gathering of their vendors who make things for them, and this was a room with probably close to 1,000 people in this room. It was astounding. And it was like a pep talk kind of thing, and Noel Lee was the last guy on, you know. And these are just people who supply them. Now, we used to be a supplier of Monster. I can tell you that, because it's been a long time now, 10, 15 years. And at one point, we were making, 20% of their products. And there was one year they won 3 awards. All of them were for cables that we were making for them. But A, were we too expensive? B, we took our own sweet time because we actually did it right and we told them what we were doing. And none of these things they liked. And so in fact, they took our entire line and they went offshore and they started having them made in China. They looked very close or even exactly the same. And the fact that they weren't the same stuff, that didn't matter to them, you know, because nobody could tell the difference. But the most interesting thing was the main factory they went to with all their new stuff was a company called LTK in China. So we bought LTK. That was the solution to that problem.
Nice.
So.
Still bought. Do you know anything about the magic blocks on the ends of the cables? With
magic
blocks. And you know, I saw articulation poles mentioned in the announcement.
Yeah.
Could you tell me what is in those blocks? And what an articulation pole is?
Well, my understanding, an articulation pole is talking about how the atoms are arranged inside the conductors of the cable.
The Shakti stone?
No, that's a stone. That's different.
You want the electromagnetic radiation of your speaker to be in tune with the vibrations of the universe, right?
Yeah.
That's a Shakti stone.
Yeah.
Well,
how you choose them is beyond me. But
yeah.
We have seen a bunch of speaker cables and things out there with little network boxes on the ends. They just throw some resistors and capacitors in there to basically you know, tune the sound. And of course, with an RC network, you can tune the sound. There's no secret to that. Why do you want to? Is, you know, perhaps a better question.
$30,000.
Yeah. Oh, and silly money for components you could buy at Radio Shack for $3 and solder to the end of your cable yourself.
You're sending that into the EQ, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And the little network, the articulation poles thing, I thought was a wonderful example, actually, of JJ showed me the write-up on those online, and it's one of those things which is beautifully written from the standpoint that if you know nothing, it sounds very scientific.
Yeah.
Essentially, what they say is at every frequency, you've got to have a balance of the capacitance and the inductance in the cable to optimize sound at that frequency, and every cable will have an articulation pole, which is this point where it's an optimized, say, 1 kilohertz, but it falls off the edges. And so we can make cables that have many of these articulation poles in them. Of course, I read that and I think it sounds like you're saying the cable's going to resonate at these frequencies, which is, of course, exactly the opposite of
actually,
what
you ever
want.
Actually, that is what they claim. They claim that the articulation pole is a combination of the inductance, the resistance, and the capacitance of the cable.
Which
that,
we call impedance, you know. I mean, there's a word for that.
All normal cables have one articulation pole, but they say that this isn't good enough, that you actually need four. And so their cable somehow creates four articulation poles instead of...
Yeah, now the question is, how can you get a cable to have more than one impedance at a time? This is an interesting subject, which, you know...
Well, but, you know, if they were saying it was resonating at a certain frequency or something like that, you can have something that resonates at a variety of associated wavelengths, but the problem is you don't want it to do that. You don't want standing waves in the cable. And, of course, at audio frequencies, this isn't going to happen anyway unless we're talking about cables that are miles long, it ain't going to resonate. If you're the phone company, you have to worry about stuff like that.
Exactly.
The rest of us, not so much. But the beautiful thing, and I think everybody, it's well worth a read. You take a look at the MIT Cables website and read about articulation poles. It's the kind of thing that it really sounds like it was written by a smart guy who really knows what he's talking about, except if you have a modicum of electronic knowledge, you'll read it and say,
What
the hell? You know, they're banking on the fact that a lot of people don't have a modicum of electronic knowledge.
Yes.
Some of their cables do have network boxes on them.
Yeah, sure.
Yeah.
Another one of the other things that I thought maybe you were going to mention, I've seen also cables with a resistor in them, and basically kicks up the QTS of the woofer. It booms more and people like it. I've seen that.
We ran into somebody at one point who was making audio interconnect cables out of what, as best I could tell, was spark plug wire. It was essentially conductive carbon fiber in a jacket, and so it had massive resistance. And there you had, I didn't do the numbers on it because it wasn't my product, but I was looking at it and thinking there's enough combined capacitance and resistance in this that the thing might really have some pretty wacky RC kind of characteristics. Again, why? Why would you ever want that? I can't imagine. But you know, although one thing we encounter fairly often is when you have wacky cables. The commonest example right now is the braided Cat5 interconnect or speaker cable. People take Cat5; it's great cable because you can steal it from work, and you bring home a couple of spools of Cat5, and you want a couple of 10-foot speaker cables. You take about 500 feet of Cat5. You strip the jackets. You take all the pairs out. You start, you know, untwist the very ends, you braid them all together in an elaborate, you know, special top secret audiophile braid.
Blitz wire.
And then, yeah, and exactly. That's the whole kind of thing. You've got basically this gigantic mass of insulated individual conductors, and you solder half of them to one pole and half of them to the other pole. Now you've got this thing that has gigantic capacitance. If you put it on an amp, you may just burn out the final. The speaker cables are a little dicey that way. If you use it as an audio interconnect, it's not likely to hurt anything, but what it will do is roll off highs like crazy. And interestingly, The subjective reports actually are fairly consistent with that. People talk about these having a warmer, softer, lush kind of sound, which might be just what you get when you chop all the high frequencies out of the audio.
That kind of brings us back to what you were saying about the high cost, and you know, that they pay a lot of money, so they want to hear a difference in sound.
Well,
I've maintained over the years that they indeed do find a difference in sound, but it's worse, not better.
Well, that's the
in terms of accuracy of reproduction.
Because it's just about what you have to do. You start out with the 17 cents a foot cable. It sounds perfect. It's got to sound different from that.
Yeah.
The only direction you can go
is down.
Is down.
You don't understand. It's better than perfect.
Yeah. No. I've talked to people who believe that some cables are louder than other cables.
Yeah.
And it's like, how is this possible? This
straight wire with gain.
Yeah, straight wire with gain.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Gain wire.
Distortion.
I mean, I would be a millionaire.
Wire distortion can make things louder. Maybe they put in a really bad inductor that's saturating or something. That would make it louder.
Yeah.
Possibly. But the whole point is, and this is a problem that we as a manufacturer run into all the time, which is when you bring out a product, the one thing you have to do is differentiate this product from everybody else's product. Now, if I'm bringing out Zipcord, there's really, if it's, 12-gauge Zipcord, there are 100 other 12-gauge Zipcords out there. How can I differentiate this product from them? Well, I could say it's, more consistent, and I could talk about dimensions, and I could talk about stranding, and I could talk about copper, and I could talk about resistance, I could talk about this list up here, kind of thing. But then after a while, they could too, of course. And after a while, I begin to run out of things. Which is why I think a lot of people want to put a box at the end or something inside or a resistor or something so they have something to talk about.
Yeah, wire's boring.
Yeah.
I mean, that's why we're all here.
I'm amazed how many people here to talk about wire. I mean, this is like the world's most boring subject.
Yeah, I know.
You're making money, though.
Well, do you feel as if there is any merit, any advantage that could be seen to having, say, oxygen-free?
Well, really what we're talking about there is the last thing up there, copper purity. And you can get more and more purity in anything, including copper. The thing is, now I could sell you, we actually buy, I'll give you an example, we buy two kinds of copper at Belden. And you specify them, like you would specify the kind of peach or orange or banana you're going to buy, and you could get that, delivered to you. Ours is called ASTM, American Society of Standards of Testing Materials. ASTM B115 ETP, electrolytic tough pitch. Thank you. Mm-hmm. And that is a specific kind of copper that we buy from Phelps Dodge or Anaconda or these people who own copper mines. And they deliver it in giant coils of wire that's about that big. And then we squeeze it through dies to make it smaller and smaller and smaller. But it starts out with that specific purity. The interesting thing is that purity is 99.95% pure. And what's most of that after that is sulfur, not oxygen. But, that's where people start saying, is this oxygen free? Well, there's no oxygen free. Is this free enough, 99.95? If not, then we move over to what's called ASTM B170, which is 99.995, another 9 in there. So, and when we make a lot of home products now, we use this other copper because so many people say it has to be oxygen free, so we have to start talking about purity. We kind of change it over to the purity side and say, here's what we bought for you. Yes, it costs more for that copper because it's harder for the copper guy to make it from his copper mine, but this is what you want. Now, can I hear the difference between the two? Well, no, that's a subjective question, right?
Can you test it?
Oh, I can test it. I can measure the difference in resistance. It's microscopic. It's less than 1% difference in resistance, kind of thing. So over 1,000 feet, I might see a tenth of an ohm or some number.
Didn't the Navy, I heard that oxygen-free was the Navy was unreeling miles of cable to do radio frequency stuff in the ocean, and oxygen free just made the copper not break after reeling it in and reeling it out and reeling it in over and
no,
over.
No, that's called annealing.
Annealing, okay.
And that's where you take copper, when you go through the die to make big into small, you then stick it in an oven, which is about 700 degrees. It's not anywhere near enough to melt the copper, but what it does is allow the molecules of copper to come back into contact with each other and put the flexibility back. So, in fact, if you ever play with a wire that breaks after a few things, it means it's not annealed very well. It's part of the process of making the copper. And that's the thing. A lot of people still won't use solid wire, like, you know, Cat 5, for instance. They won't use that wire because it's going to break. And the point is, they don't realize that if it's correctly annealed, you can flex that 2,000 or 3,000 times before it breaks. That this is not a problem. It's about processing the cable. So it really has nothing to do with oxygen at all. It has to do with a process.
It's the same deal with wire wrap wire, isn't it?
Absolutely. Same thing.
And when you're thinking about, you know, the difference in terms of copper purity, to go back to your question, what you have to understand is what you're worried about here. The difference in resistance is incredibly negligible, and in most applications, resistance isn't even an important consideration unless you're delivering a lot of power. And what you are concerned with is deterioration of wire due to corrosion, and the vectors for corrosion are generally something which has a polyethylene dielectric extruded over it. You can let that sit around in a wet place for 20 years, come out with a pair of snips and strip it and find clean, bright copper underneath. It's at termination points, things like that, that you actually have to be concerned with corrosion. And there, copper purity is the least of your problems. You know, you have to worry, am I getting saltwater spray in a marine application or something like that? So, you know, the copper purity, as long as it's good enough, really never comes into it. It's impressive just how long-lasting copper is. I've got old ham radio coax I bought in the 1970s, and if I strip a piece of that, it's clean and bright today as the day it was made. It's not even the good stuff.
What about gold and silver?
Well, gold is used for connector plating just because it's non-corrosive. Nickel's just as good, but the consumer expects gold now, so everything's gold.
Oh, actually, I think the next slide. There's the resistance in circular mill ohms per foot at 20 degrees C changes with temperature. Silver's number one. Copper's number two, but you look at the difference, the delta in price.
Yeah.
Plus, silver is really hard to deal with because it's very brittle.
And it won't anneal.
And it doesn't anneal. So you really, that's why copper, everything starts out with copper. I just read today, however, that there is one cable manufacturer who is concerned about all the copper thievery that's going on, since copper is now at an all-time high of like $5 a pound. And so there's some 35 to 40 people a year are being killed trying to steal copper from ground wires and high-tension wires and railroads and places you shouldn't be. And so what the manufacturers are doing are bringing out copper-clad steel wires to replace the copper wires. Well, wait a minute. That steel is, look at steel compared to copper. I mean, unbelievable. So all this does is, this is a joke on the guy who steals the wire, but it doesn't work very well when you buy it.
Well, this is where the skin effect is a good thing.
Yeah, if you're going to do skin effect, then it's fine, which is why all your cable TV cables are copper-clad steel, because you don't start until channel 2. Actually, now you don't start until channel 12, you know, or something. And so the whole point is, you don't go down to those low frequencies anymore. You don't need an all copper wire.
Yeah. But, you know, the thing is, there's sort of a different set of priorities for choice of metal depending on the application. Again, for conductors, you see a lot of silver and copper. You see silver plated onto copper for things like microwave applications a lot. You see it in plenum cables where there's corrosive dielectric and things like that. But the thing about silver and copper is they both will tarnish. And so when you're looking for a connector and you want a shell that's going to be exposed to the elements on a regular basis that isn't going to tarnish, you want some non-corrosive coating. And that's why suddenly you start to see gold and nickel on things, because although they're not nearly, well, gold's quite good, but and nickel's not particularly good as a conductor, you're only going through a few micro inches of it, but it's protecting the brass typically, which is underneath in the connector body, from corroding and falling apart.
How about iridium?
Iridium.
You have something to sell?
No.
All right.
If I did, I'd not be here.
If I had some palladium, I'd do some cold fusion. Although if anybody studies too closely whether the cold fusion works, the effect goes away.
Yeah, one of those.
Well, you know, this stuff they are accusing James Randi out there. Some guy claiming that James Randi is the world's most powerful psychic. He's using his psychic powers to shut everybody else down.
That's a wonderful claim, and falls beautifully
it's
in
the
non-falsifiable category.
Yeah, exactly. Unverifiable claims. That's you could make a whole book of that.
And there are books of those.
They're all true. Yeah.
Or not even wrong.
Or not even wrong. I want to say one thing about gold, which is interesting, because a lot of people have asked me if we've ever made gold wires, and yes, in one particular instance, we made lots and lots of gold wire, and you'll be very interested to learn this was the Manhattan Project, that when they were wiring up Los Alamos and those test facilities, that copper was unavailable because of the war. And aluminum was still hard to get at the time, and so they ended up saying, how about gold? And they said, fine. So they went to Fort Knox. This is a true story, believe it or not. They got 2 tons of gold out of Fort Knox. If they went to the Belden factory, nobody's talking still, because it was all very secret at the time. And this was all made into wire, which went into the facility. And at the end of the war, they took the facility apart, took all the gold wire out, sent it back where it came from. And after this, they were only missing 2 ounces out of 2 tons, which is pretty good. You imagine the security at Los Alamos was pretty darn good. You know, people walking in and out, you couldn't take some wire with you. So that's the only time I've ever heard that gold was made in any great consistency and great quantity into wire.
And okay. Not because it was such great wire.
And it's not, no, it's terrible wire, but yeah. It's all they could get. It's very easy, great to use, easy to extrude. I mean, you could extrude gold down to tiny wires, which is why inside ICs and stuff, those are all gold wires. It's only because you can make them in, you know, you can go down to 60 gauge, where you can't even see kind of stuff, and still get a wire that works perfectly well. It's just not very good resistance. So, you know, inside an IC, you're going to go, you know, 1/100 of an inch or something. That's fine. Yeah.
So could you walk us through the attributes of a competent interconnect cable and the attributes of a competent speaker cable? Nothing fancy, just competent.
Sure. I mean, for speaker cable, your number one consideration, far and above everything else, is just resistance. And, of course, that equates ordinarily just to plain old wire gauge. Bigger is better up to a point. And you know, you can choose different criteria. Basically, speaker damping factor considerations like that are going to cause you to have some roll-off if the gauge is inadequate, and how many dB of roll-off you're willing to tolerate, and how long a run length basically determines your gauge. And Steve's book actually has some tables for that, calculating on the basis of like a half dB roll-off, something like that, what gauge is suitable for a run of what kind of distance. That's what we're talking about, you know, conventional like 4-ohm, 8-ohm speaker cable kind of runs. I'm not as familiar with the, you know, the 70-volt systems and things like that, but it's essentially the same question. Resistance being low is good because you want to deliver a lot of power and you want to deliver it efficiently. There are minimal sort of requirements for inductance and capacitance. You just don't want inductance or capacitance to be nutty. If you take something like those braided Cat 5 speaker cables I was talking about, you know, you can drive a final stage of an amplifier into oscillation, you have a lot of roll-off, you have all kinds of crazy stuff. If inductance and capacitance are reasonable values, you're fine.
Can I jump in here?
Yes.
One thing I'll tell you is, and this is also in my book, my latest book, from McGraw-Hill, go buy one, which is looking at the capacitance. People say they want to have lower and lower capacitance because they know capacitance gives you roll-off, you know, gives you a slope. And the thing is that capacitance is only a factor based on the source impedance of the device that's driving it. So if you have a 150-ohm mic, like, you know, this kind of thing, or something like that, yes, the capacitance of the cable will tell you how far you can go, what kind of slope characteristic you'll have. But you look at the output impedance of a power amplifier, it's not 50 ohms or 10 ohms. In fact, it's not even 8 ohms or 4 ohms. Like, it's really like 0.02 ohms or some microscopic number, which if you do the math means you don't begin to fall off until you're like 10 miles out there, in which case then it doesn't matter what the capacitance of the speaker cable is. And I'm saying that even though it says in the home part of our catalog, it says low capacitance speaker cable, because this is what people ask for. And it's like, it doesn't matter what the capacitance is. And plus, you look at the inductance of speaker cable, unless you know, how do you get an inductor? You wind the wire up, and then you get to a microhenry, you know? I mean, the amount of inductance in a straight piece of wire is so close to zero. Well, we never tell you what it is in the catalog. You could look it up on the data sheet, maybe, but there's nothing there. And so, therefore, these things, you know, C and R in terms of speaker cables. And then what he was saying is that you need gauge size because this is current delivery. You know, you're delivering current to the speaker. This isn't voltage. This isn't high frequency stuff. The only thing you have is current. That's resistance. That's gauge size. Big wires is better than small wires, although, you know, I would say there's probably, you know, the ends justify the means, except, you know, I don't know if I'd put, you know, jumper cables on your speakers, but you could if you wanted to. We go up to 10 gauge now, but I have a project right now where I'm going to bring out 8 gauge and 6 gauge speaker cables, and that's specifically for these 10 kilowatt amplifiers that are out there. I use 10 kilowatts in quotes because, you know, I don't believe they really are 10 kilowatts.
Right on one branch circuit.
Yeah, 10 kilowatts off of a 20 amp breaker. Yeah, it's pretty clever, you know. So, but the point is that they're saying they need 8 and 6 gauge if they're going to go more than 150 feet, in which case I'm going to make them 8 and 6 gauge speaker cable. And this will not be cheap, I can tell you that, because it's a lot of copper.
It's a lot of copper. It ramps up the cost very quickly.
Yeah.
But gauge is everything. And, of course, the main reason, too, it's not just that you're trying to be energy efficient, but that the speaker's impedance will vary with frequency. And so, obviously, taking Ohm's law, you know, you're burning up some fraction of it in the speaker cable. You get a flatter response, the less resistance that you have in the speaker cable. If you're talking about interconnects, you know, your biggest things with balanced interconnects are you want common mode noise rejection, you want reasonably effective shielding, and you want reasonably low capacitance. And, of course, if it's a digital balanced interconnect, you need a good impedance consistency, especially if you're running over long distances. And, of course, if you're dealing with a microphone application or something like that, noise rejection is suddenly the biggest consideration of all, and you're looking at probably going to star quad or something of that nature. But it's all, you know, it's all capacitance and shielding and just ordinary kind of measurable properties like that. You go to unbalanced, which is where most of my world is because I'm in consumer AV, and really all you care about anymore, you've got very high impedance circuits, the resistance is irrelevant pretty much, you're interested in capacitance and shield effectiveness, and you got no common mode noise rejection, so the only noise rejection you got is shielding, and depending on your environment, that's either highly critical or not important, really.
I use unshielded interconnects quite often with absolutely no detrimental effects.
Are you running unbalanced?
Unbalanced, single-ended.
Yeah, and obviously dependent on your environment. We get calls from people. They'll say, I actually live next door to a radio station, and it comes in my system. And then what we say is, you know, run like a combination braid and foil coax so that you get very high RFI rejection from the foil on the coax. If they aren't in some kind of a high RFI environment, we usually direct them to something that's just a high coverage copper braid type of shielding because that's highly effective at audio frequencies.
Can you explain in an unbalanced cable, since the shield is the return path of the actual audio, how it's actually a shield in a way?
Well, I mean, it's tied to ground.
And
typically, I'm not exactly sure I understand the question. But
I'm not sure I understand it either. That's one of the
But yeah, I mean, it's just a kind of a different animal. You're not dealing with differentials. You're just dealing with a signal that's a voltage relative to ground, and it's problematic. What we find in consumer audio video, because we're dealing with a lot of people with specialized installations, people who've put a projector at one end of the room and they've got an amp in a stack over here, but they may have some source devices out here. And all of a sudden, ground loops become a big problem in unbalanced circuits, and it's really, really hard to control. You can't telescope your grounds on your cables because you're using the ground as your signal return path. It gets more noisy if you telescope the ground.
Can you describe,
not
define
less.
Telescope, please?
I'm sorry. That's where you cut the shield off at one end. People do this in a ground loop situation in a balanced circuit because all your signals on the two conductors inside, if the ground cut path isn't completed between pieces of gear, you lose a little shield effectiveness, but that's all, and you can cut the ground loop.
And if you do that, you need to keep the source grounded and disconnect the destination ground because one's low impedance, one's high impedance. And that is the most effective of all is to have both grounds connected And what that means is now you need to work on the ground system in your building to make sure every metal object in the building that you're going to attach to is at the same exact ground potential, in which case there's no ground loops. You know, but that's a lot of work and a lot of money.
There is a ground loop. There's no ground current.
That's right. There's no ground current. Exactly. Yes?
So when you say you want low capacitance internet cable, what kind of values are you talking about? What constitutes low?
Well, put it this way. That's a very good question. The lowest capacitance we currently make in a twisted pair is 13 picofarads per foot. And I can show this. Right here.
Well, what's reasonable? What do you need?
Well, unfortunately, it's application. It's also application dependent. You know, my younger brother is the audio engineer over at Victory Studios over on 15th Avenue in Interbay, and I was just in his studio the other day. He's showing me a microphone preamp which they had a hell of a time with. Everybody loved this tube preamp. It had a great sound, which was useful to a lot of the clients in rendering things the way they wanted to render them. Problem was that it would sound great when you auditioned the thing, and then it would sound like crap whenever they employed it in a session. And eventually they figured out that although the cable they were using was quite low capacitance, it's all going through a patch panel at the other end of the building. So they were actually driving with this tube preamp a very, very long cable, and the cable basically is a capacitive load on the final stage of that preamp. This thing could not handle having a lot of capacitance. There, we're probably talking about 200 feet of cable at the end of the circuit. So, if that was something like this AES EBU type product that Steve is talking about, you know, it's 200 times 13, and that's how much capacitance. That's not very much.
30 is about an average number for most cables. 30 picofarads per foot. If you get really cheap cables that are all PVC, you can get up to 50 picofarads per foot. I've actually seen stuff out of Asia that's 100 picofarads per foot, and I don't even know how that's physically possible to get
that bad.
I have an interesting anecdote about that. We have some cheap Chinese microphones at work. Actually, sound really nice, but you can only put they run off of a 48-volt Phantom, and you can only put about 8 feet of even good mic cable on it before they start to current limit at high frequencies.
Yeah, exactly.
So that's just one of the places you can get burned.
That's another thing.
Must have the crappiest drivers in
them. I
was going to say, you know, the trick in a situation like that, sometimes you just need to engineer around it some way other than cable. In that case, say at the studio, what they did is they ran a 4-foot cable into another preamp, which was a solid state preamp that was not sensitive to being given a big capacitive load to drive. And now it can go through the patch panel and everything else, and not a problem. And likewise, in that kind of situation.
We just stuck our solid state recorder under the mic tree.
Yeah.
Yeah. See, this is one thing that a lot of people don't realize is that there are a lot of systems out there, of which Phantom Powering is one of them, that has a frequency component, you know, some signal, and then a power component at the same time. Another of those is like satellite dishes with an LNA, a low noise amplifier in the dish. That coax is supplying DC to that and bringing your RF back the other way. So the cable's doing two things at the same time. And the point is the limiting factor on all of these systems is the DC limit of that power going in there, because then the only thing that matters is the resistance of the wire. And, you know, like this cable I'm passing around is 24 gauge. That's pretty high resistance when you think about it. So it's going to limit how far this can go carrying some kind of phantom signal. I could, of course, sell you a mic cable that's 20 gauge. That would go a lot farther, but, you know, in terms of resistance, in terms of phantom powering or something else.
Kurt, was that an English preamp by chance yet?
You know, I don't remember the name of the gear. He showed it to me the other day, and I just didn't note it.
Did it say equalized with an S? They're just joking.
But yeah, it's very sensitive. He apparently quite one of those little problems that drives everybody crazy until they figure it out, and then has a very simple solution.
Has any of the exotic cable companies picked up on trying to market how the wire is drawn, how it's reduced in diameter?
Oh, absolutely.
Oh, yeah?
Oh, they have all sorts of grain structure and I'm trying to remember, Cardis Audio?
Continuous cast copper.
Continuous cast, yeah, exactly.
Right.
You know, the funny thing about it that I've noticed when you look at some of the things that people claim for things like that, they'll have a term like continuous cast copper. I think that's Cardus.
Single grain.
Or single grain.
Yeah, yeah.
And what you'll always notice with these things is that these things are protected intellectual property, but what they are is they're trademarks. They're not patents because they don't actually do anything. But you can give a trade name to something. You know, they make us a bonded pair cable. Well, if I want to say that's stable bond TM Blue Jeans cable brand stuff, I can trademark that, and then I have the exclusive right to use that. Doesn't exactly mean I own the process for bonding pairs, but it sure means that nobody else can call theirs what I call mine. And that's, you know, it's another one of those kind of little snake oil tip-offs that when you start seeing a lot of trademarks thrown around that don't seem to have any substantive intellectual property underlying them. It's a suggestion that somebody has simply said, this is a twisted pair, but it's boring to say it's a twisted pair, so I've come up with, you know, stable twist, and that's what I call it, and you can only get stable twist at Fred Smith Audio.
Twin axe.
Twin axe. Oh, yeah, twin axe is a real word.
Just a twisted pair. Lawyer.
Yeah.
Recovery.
Recovering.
Yeah. It hasn't recovered very well. But
I have sort of like a more of a consumer-based question.
Sure.
I was at NAMM, and like, so there's a lot of companies out there making cable. There's a Swiss one called Govox, and they've got this real elaborate-looking cable, and I'm just kind of curious what your thoughts are on stuff like that, or, you know, I guess, like, Hosa has the Zeola brand. It's, I guess...
Yeah, that's all silver.
So I was just curious what your thoughts are on those, or if you even looked at them.
I ogle those at CES. They always look very pretty.
I mean, they're very pretty, and they're very expensive, but I often question... I mean, I've got a lot of stuff that's Belden or Megami cable in my setup, but, you look at that, and I try to ask them, you know, do people really buy into that they need to buy this cable? What makes it better? And I'm just curious if you've looked at your head.
I haven't looked at those particular brands. I can tell you that in a lot of cases, what's interesting is that for all the pseudoscience being thrown around and all the kind of made-up scientific terminology and all that, the amazing thing is that when you start to meet, as I have, a lot of the people that actually market these products, the impression I'm left with is they are either the greatest swindlers ever or they're absolutely sincere. And I'm inclined to think that for the most part it's absolutely sincere. A lot of these guys are true believers and they spend hours sitting around, you know, twisting wire up in funny ways and then plugging it into things and listening to it and saying, you know, is this more dynamic? Is this more musical? Is this straighter?
Well, the cable, for example, and I didn't look at it really super close because obviously it was all put together and I couldn't really see the end like the cable we were just looking at now. But to me, it looked like they were basically taking the cable like you just passed around, that nicely made, heavily shielded. I mean, it's Swiss and they make pretty good stuff quite often. But then, like, instead of being like a quad cable, they were taking like two cables like that and then twisting those together, and I guess one side of your balance signal goes in one and your other balance side goes, I don't really know why they needed it to be that thick, but I was just curious in your mind how that would be good or if it's just kind of a gimmick to make
you
it
know you need a mathematician who specializes in topology probably to work this out, but what I can tell you is that in general things like consistency and common noise rejection and things like that you're concerned with are favored by simple geometry, not by, you know, taking pairs and twisting them and then twisting the pairs with each other and things
what
like
the
that.
Volvox cable looks like it's doing. I don't know if anybody else has seen this, but it's VOVOX, so you can take a look at it.
Okay, we'll go look at it.
Yeah, I'd be curious.
I will say to on the other side of this, and this is a problem with a lot of things, is that people can take a grain of truth and spin that grain until it's, you know, way beyond anything that was ever intended. And one of those are manufacturers, one of which is Kimber, that does lots of twisted pairs but end up unbalanced. And the point is, you have to realize the twisted pairs only reject noise when they're set up as a balanced line run with a differential signal. And if you run it unbalanced, then you have thrown away everything you have ever done by twisting those wires together. Yes?
Well, actually, I've heard it used a lot to reduce the likelihood of induced signals.
Yeah, but it doesn't. Right. Once you unbalance it, that effect is gone away.
Well, for the unbalanced, it's where one of the pair is grounded. So it's basically just uses a 50% shield.
Yeah, right. it's just a shield.
It just doesn't work.
You might as well just put a shield around it. That's what you want.
And what you typically wind up with then, you know, you've now taken... What you find, you know, you strip the cable jacket, is that typically your density of shield coverage isn't as good on twisted pair cables, often because they're intended to be highly flexible. And for other reasons, like, you know, we sell 1800F, which is a Belden product. It has what they call a fringe braid shield. Okay, yeah, so you're looking at it. And something like that doesn't quite give you the shield coverage that you would get if you just had a simple coaxial cable with a single center conductor and a 95% copper braid over top, or you know, better yet, if you're concerned about RFI, braid over foil. And so what winds up happening is that people do this kind of quasi-balanced wiring and unbalanced interconnects, and they're not really doing themselves any favors. And incidentally, in the process, by going to a cable that simply doesn't have the same kind of shield effectiveness, mostly because it doesn't need it when used in its intended application, they're just losing shield effectiveness. In a lot of applications, it won't matter, of course. It'll work fine. But if you do get into a situation where there are induced noise problems and things like that, you're just better off in unbalanced with a coax with a low resistance shield.
And what about the spiral versus braid?
Well, a spiral shield will always open up a little bit as the cable flexes, you know, and that's the problem with a spiral shield. It's reasonably effective, but braid will give you better coverage. I mean, if it's a high coverage braid, you can have a 40% braid, so you need to look.
Now, there's also a Royston shield, which is two spirals on top of each other, which is better than a single spiral. The braid has the tightest coverage because no matter how you bend the cable, it can't come apart. It's all braided together. The interesting thing is there is one in between, which is actually on that cable you've all been looking
French
at.
Braid.
I don't know if you noticed it, that the braid is only braided along one axis, and the rest of the time it looks like a spiral. This is something called a French braid. And so it has the flexibility of a spiral, which is why spirals, people like them, because they're very, very flexible. And yet because it's braided along one axis, it can't open up. So it actually has the coverage of a braid shield, but the flexibility of a spiral shield.
It preps easier.
And it preps easier. Well, that's because there's a drain wire underneath this as well, which people argue with me about as well. It's like some people love drain wires, some people hate drain wires, and you don't have to use it. You know, it's just there. No, I think it's gone all the way. The baby hasn't seen it.
Could you say something about foil as far as desirability in audio use for shielding and laser rejection?
Foil is high-frequency shields, number one. Foils really don't begin to work until about 10 megahertz. So if you think you're going to foil shield something at audio frequencies and keep audio frequencies in or out, ain't going to do anything. In fact, the truth is that a braid shield, even a braid shield, only goes down to about 1,000 hertz. So if you're talking about shielding 60 hertz...
Yeah.
Forget it. There is no shield on earth that I could put into this cable that will do any good at all. And even things like a solid steel conduit, perfectly installed, will be about 30 dB at 60 hertz. I mean, it's amazing. 60 hertz goes through everything. It's unstoppable.
Wonderful stuff.
Wonderful stuff, which is why the one thing that really will get rid of 60 hertz is a balanced line. That's what does it. So either a bonded pair or star quad. That's why that's the big thing about star quad is you can relay star quad next to a power cable and it doesn't see it at all, as long as it's connected correctly, of course. But the whole point is with a foil shield, that's really high frequency stuff. If you're trying to prevent RF from coming back in on your audio, which is a serious problem in some cases, that's why you look at 8451 or 9451. That's a foil over an audio pair. That foil is to prevent RF from coming back in the cable. That's what that's there for. The other thing about foil is it's not intended to be moved while the cable is in operation, because you'll hear the foil moving around in the cable. It will change the capacitance between the pair, and you'll actually hear that capacitive noise, something we call tribal electric noise. And so those cables, if you see foil in the cable, it's intended to be installed and left and not moved. And that's why you look at a mic cable like that yellow cable we were passing around. There's no foil in there. because that would make it noisy. A braid is much less noisy than foil.
So it basically doesn't really add any benefit, and it's potentially hazardous due to an increase in capacitance and the flex noise.
Yeah, and it's a lot cheaper, though, and smaller, and easier to make, you know? Yeah. That's why there's so many foil pairs out there.
Yeah,
that's install.
Quite often it's foil and braid, both.
Yeah, in which case I would still be looking at the foil. That foil still would make it noisy.
Right.
A foil braid cable is still not a mic cable.
But
this is one reason why, even when we get to fat patch cables that do digital video, for instance, we're talking up in the gigahertz, those have no foil in them because they would be noisy in the video realm at high frequencies as well. So it's like the densest braid we can give you kind of thing. And it's not that good at high frequencies, but it's the best we can do.
Did you discuss some of the cable manufacturers' claims about how their networks keep these radio frequencies from coming back into the amp and taxing the power capacity of the amp?
You know, that doesn't make any sense to me.
well, if there's a filter on the thing.
Well, I mean, obviously you can use a network box as a low pass filter. That's easy enough to do. The question is it really going to hurt if a little bit of RF goes back down into the final of your power amp? And I would think if your power amp is well designed, it probably doesn't matter the least little bit. And you know, when you think about how many dB that noise is below the signal that's coming out of that amp, it's just negligible. If you ever sat in a room with a speaker that wasn't hooked up to anything, or it was hooked up only to a cable and heard RF coming in through the speaker cone.
Well, they're
cone.
Talking
it takes
about
a lot
really
of power.
Expensive amps that have flat bandwidth to a gigahertz or something.
Yeah, exactly.
Well,
I don't know.
If you take one, though, almost any power amp has a little inductor at the output, and it has to have a little inductor at the output just to keep the loop gain from going completely bonkers when you hook up capacitance.
Yeah.
So, you know, unless there's something wrong with that inductor,
Well, I sat through this long talk with Transparent Audio, and they were convinced. They promised everyone in the room, it's like, you might think you've got a bad seat, but everyone is going to hear the difference. And I've got pretty good ears, and I can hear the difference between SPDIF and AES digital cables and clocking and weird stuff like that. I didn't hear anything on their $10,000 cables. But the description of the electronics and how they're keeping this amp from going crazy made a little bit of sense, but it only made sense if it was tuned to your particular amp and your particular speaker.
And the RF that you're trying to get rid of.
Right. It seems like you could fix a potential problem that way, but you couldn't fix it for every amp and every speaker crossover.
No.
They'd have to tune that network to your gear if it was going to do anything. And I don't care if it's $10,000. It can't fix an unknown amp.
There's another point to that, that if the amplifier was reasonably well designed, it shouldn't matter.
It wouldn't need to.
I got into a big debate with a gentleman formerly with Parasound. I saw you, Sicker. On one of the boards, I said, well, you know, somebody's arguing that the fancy power cables were taking RF out of the power supply. My comment was, if your power supply wasn't capable of rejecting RF, I was a little more blunt than that, but... Got this big lecture on how I didn't know anything about how to design power supplies. Do you know how hard it is to keep broadcast signals out of my power supplies?
Well, and the thing is, if that's a subject interests you, go Google pin one.
I can buy X capacitors anywhere. You know, how many X capacitors can you buy for $1? I mean, you know, this was a 0.1 microfarad, you know, 600 volt line rated capacitors, you know?
I have had audiophiles patiently explain to me that it's precisely because the amp is so good and so sensitive and capable of such resolution and detail that it's incapable of doing a halfway decent job of rejecting noise from each and every possible source you can imagine. That, you know, you can consider whether that's a meritorious argument, I think. But it strikes me as, at the very least, a terribly impractical argument, and I don't know any engineer who would design equipment and be satisfied with half-assed noise rejection when that ought to be easy to accomplish with relation to other more difficult objectives like accuracy of reproduction.
Well, there's this whole book by Doug Self that sort of just think ought to clear up a lot of that. His amplifier design book. I wouldn't say it's the absolute be-all and end-all, but there's an awful lot of good circuit design in it. You know the book I mean?
Can I add one more thing about speakers and shielding before we get too far off? And that is, one of the things that people don't think about is the fact that and I sell large-gauge cables that have foil shields in them. That foil shield is only intended to prevent RF from getting in there. If you buy a 12-gauge shielded cable, don't expect the audio from that cable to not get into the next cable because that foil shield's doing nothing at audio frequencies. And plus, you have to think about this, the output of your regular amplifier is not a balanced line, and therefore this speaker cable is radiating like all get out. And the only reason it isn't interfered with very often is because the output of the amplifier is, as he mentioned, 1,000 times more than any signal is ever going to get into it. And therefore, it just overwhelms anything. But the point is, so if you have a tray of a bunch of different cables, I'd say the number one thing suggestion is to take those speaker cables and move them as far away as you can from everything else, even if that other stuff is balanced lines, simply because those speaker cables are going to radiate no matter what you do. And don't buy shielded because it's just a waste of money. Besides which, when are you going to put the shield where you attach the shield to the amp? Well, if you attach it to the amp, guess what? You look at the ground connection of your speakers, and that's exactly the same place. So you might as well just be adding another conductor to the ground side of the speaker cable. So
there's another factor that people don't always like to hear, and that is that the National Electrical Code does not allow you to run speaker cable with anything else. You can't run it in the same cable tray. You can't run it in the same conduit.
Nor power cable.
Nor. You can't run it with anything. You can't run it with line level audio. Can't run it with microphone. Can't run it with a doorbell. It must be separated from everything else.
Why is that, you know?
Pardon?
Why is that?
If I had an answer, I had an hour, I could give you my opinion as to why it is. But basically...
Have to do with any unions?
Panel 16, which writes Article 640 of the National Electrical Code, has decided in recent years that loudspeaker circuits are more akin to a power branch circuit than they are to low voltage signal conditions.
Yeah.
And if you think about it, they're absolutely right. That
right.
1 kilowatt BGW will run a Christmas tree, set of Christmas tree lights just the same
absolutely.
As the plug and
wall. And will kill you if
and
you touch
kill
the speaker
you just
output.
As fast. In fact, if you square off a big power amplifier, you'll get a couple hundred volts out of it RMS because you're putting out 100 and something square waves.
Yeah.
So it is, in fact, the same class of circuit as a branch circuit, and so therefore must be separated.
And it says you can tell on the back of the amp now, it says class 1 or class 2 wiring
yes.
will be used. That's like the wiring in your home in terms of safety. And yet the problem is that all the outputs they give you, banana plugs, speak-ons, you tell me, none of those, obviously you couldn't use those in your home. Those are not class anything. Those are not UL listed. In fact, I've been talking ad nauseum, it seems like, with Neutrik about having their speak-ons tested. I think the reason why they've avoided me is because they probably wouldn't pass class 1 or class 2. And that's what's on the back of most of these giant power amps, you know.
I actually want to talk about that a little bit more. There is a high current version of the NL4 now, which...
Yeah, but they won't test it with
UL.
I know,
but this goes back to what you're talking about with your 6 and 8-gauge cable.
Yes, exactly.
I'm interested in this cable because we manufacture a speaker product that requires 12,000 watts to operate.
I would love to provide the cable.
And what I'm concerned about is it's hard enough to try to terminate 10-gauge into these NL8 connectors.
Oh, yeah.
And even if you go to the high-current NL8, it's still basically got the same physical dimensions. So I'm wondering, in the development of this cable that you're working on, are you trying to do this? Are you working with these NL8s so that once you have the cable, you can actually get the termination on it? And how many conductors are going to be in this? Is it going to be 2-pair, 4-pair, 8-pair?
Oh, this is single pairs. Just single pairs. These are, 6 and 8 gauge are giant wires. They really are.
Yeah.
I mean, we're almost into welding cable,
Yeah.
So, and you're right, there are no connection schemes out there until you get to the industrial side, which is, in fact, where normally we send people now who are interested in that. We make all these cables in the industrial section of the catalog. It's just nothing you'd ever play with. And we could do multiples as well, giant cables of, a bunch of 6s or 8s or something, like you'd use in a factory. And they have connection schemes that are safety rated specifically for their applications. Now, you want to use those? I mean, that's the problem. I mean, I would like to get something that's specifically intended for audio, since these cables will be intended, and we'll probably say on them, audio only. It'll probably say that on the cable so people don't use it as power cables.
You'd have to have a jacket that's and wire that's flexible enough to be able to lay out at a show and then pull back.
And see, that's the thing. So we're going to go to 1,000 strands inside each of these conductors, which means the price goes up even more because it takes each of those strands as a pass through the machine.
What will be the NEC class of this cable?
That hasn't been established yet.
And that's therein lies the rub, because
yeah.
If you have a 12,000-watt amplifier, I can guarantee it's going to be Class 1 required wiring. And that
no question.
Class 2 or Class 3 cable is not legal.
Well, the 6 and 8 is going to be Class 1.
Okay. Then
that's the thing. I'm just going to go right to the top.
Use it for anything.
Why?
But,
exactly.
But,
why even?
But most of the 10 and 12 gauge stuff is Class 2 or Class 3. And
if it's class anything.
Yeah.
Most of the 10 gauge and smaller cables out there are not NEC or UL rated in any way.
Which means it's illegal to install them in a building in the United States.
Absolutely correct. And how many billion feet are in there?
A lot.
Can we talk about stranding?
Sure.
And its benefits or detriments, desirability or undesirability, as far as audio line level, and also speaker cables, I guess.
I think it's primarily just a flex life issue. You want the cable to endure flexing, and stranding, finer stranding is better, generally. Steve and I were CES once, and somebody was showing this massively stranded, I think it was automotive power cord for great big power amps. The stuff absolutely flowed like butter. It's this thick,
Dayton.
And you can look at the end of it. And
Dayton Audio.
That could be. It had something like 6,000 strands, you couldn't even see the strands. And the thing was absolutely supple. And, something like that.
So other than flexibility,
the flex life, but other than that, no importance to it. You'll hear a lot from the audiophile types about, how you get different skin effect properties with a stranded wire and all kinds of weird inductive properties and things like that. But it's all nonsense.
I personally prefer simple solid core.
That's fine. It just won't be flexible.
I don't care.
The flex life won't be as good.
Yeah.
It's a lot easier to solder most of the time.
Exactly.
But, yeah, you can hit the pin for sure,
And at line level, you're dealing with a high impedance connection, so you can afford to go down to a very small conductor. What Steve was saying about, the flex life, even just small solid wires, you can bend it. We've spent a lot of time, sometimes some very boring afternoons, just taking fine copper wire and going like this, just to see, how many flexes is this going to endure? And if you're doing that even with the cable completely unjacketed, no dielectric to protect it from over-flexing, you still flex a thin copper wire a hell of a lot of times before it breaks from metal fatigue. So, if you want flexibility, you can afford to go very thin.
Right. Well, like I say, for me, flexibility just doesn't seem to be much of an issue. I'm not in a car,
Or mic cables. Those are the two places that people ask for flexibility.
Well, I don't do microphones, so.
Yeah,
but
then
Mark,
you don't need it.
If you're using this inside a box, then it might be more work to argue with people who believe that stranded wire is the be-all and end-all.
Yeah.
Well, in fact, see, I could make an argument for solid wire for the fact that once it's bent, it stays in its shape. So if you're putting it inside a box, that actually can be a real advantage, where stranded wire begins to, undo itself and move around, and you get one strand that will short out something and you have to hold it together kind of thing, pre-tin it kind of thing.
Well, I've tried both for those exact reasons. This solid core tends to kind of stay where you put it and so on.
That bounces off the side of the enclosure and make funny noises.
Well, that's the downside.
Well,
so that's what I'm saying. It's just a lot. Most of it's mechanical.
Yeah, it's all mechanical.
Yeah.
Really, yeah.
We do a lot of crimp termination, and for that,
solid core
is just much easier to deal with.
He's doing some cool new speaker
cables.
Crimping,
you say?
Oh,
it's easier to crimp a solid core?
Yeah. Yeah.
Oh, really?
Well, you know, if you're fitting, we use a lot of Canari BNCs and RCAs and that sort of thing. So you got a little gold crimp pin. It's got a hole that's barely bigger than the wire. On a stranded cable, you've just run it through a coax stripper, and it'll tend to round off the end of the bundle a little bit as you're terminating, and spreads it. Now the thing won't go in the end, and you're in there with mini snips cutting out a strand or two so you can get the darn pin to go down on it. With a solid conductor, you never have to deal with that.
Yeah, I enjoyed that a lot. Yeah.
Steve was just asking me to mention, we now actually weld some speaker cable terminations on, and we do that with stranded wire, of course, because when you're dealing with those gauges, it's really nice to have the flexibility.
Sonic welding.
So it's room temperature. You can weld it in a press and drop the welded connector right into the palm of your hand after it's welded, and it's warm. But it's absolutely fused together. It's pretty nifty stuff. And very strong. You can do chin-ups on a pair of them.
Sonic welding?
Yeah, ultrasonic.
Can make it sound better, too?
Well, you could sell his cables.
In the cables.
Yeah. Sonically welded. I can see it now.
I'm waiting for someone on an audiophile board to either say that the ultrasonic welding imparted new special and good qualities to it, or that it broke up the microcrystalline structure of the copper in such a way that we have microdiode and microarcing and microcapacitance phenomena that are messing with the headroom and the stealth and the whatever of the sound.
Stealth. That's cool. I like stealth.
What's wrong with solder?
What's that?
What's wrong with solder?
Well, it's not as pure. This is metal to metal, which is really, when you think about it, really what you want is metal to metal. That's why in the video world, all those connectors are crimped. Nobody does solder anymore at all. It's all crimped. Because they want metal-to-metal contact. That's really where you get the best performance.
Well, and when you're dealing with a high-mass connector, like a banana plug, and with a high-mass wire, like a speaker cable, if you solder those things, you have a hell of a time with insulation melt-back. You just melt insulation like mad as you get that joint hot enough to take the solder, where the weld being basically a room temperature operation, you cut that insulation in your wire stripper, and it looks after the weld exactly like it looked when you cut it. And that's nice. It's nice from our standpoint, not just because you don't have to worry about melting it to the point that you've got to cut it all up and re-terminate it, but also because it just looks nice from the consumer point of view. It makes a nice, tidy little installation.
I was thinking more in terms of electrical performance, though.
Oh, from an electrical performance standpoint,
welded.
Yeah, your welded joint is the lowest resistance of the bunch of them, but the solder isn't bad. You typically got a lot of surface area for a solder joint like that, so although lead isn't such a great conductor,
or tin,
a lot of it.
It seems to me that mechanical reliability is one of the biggest factors of all when it comes to connectors.
Yeah.
That's why this Sonobon stuff is so good, because it's more reliable than the solder joint.
So what's your opinion on some of the IDC connectors styles for the smaller gauges, 24, 26,
28? This is how the computer world runs all the time, is punching wires down. And there are advantages to IDC connectors, such as the fact that it's oxygen-free in terms of how when you punch it down, because the whole thing is enclosed, literally. And it only displaces the jacket of the wire where the connection is made. That's the only place. So there's some advantages. The problem is it takes up a lot of space to do something like this. So if you have a big wall in the back of your business and you're banging wires down, it's great. If you're trying to do it inside a little connector, sometimes it doesn't work so well. I know, for instance, Neutrik has an IDC XLR. And I have yet to find somebody who uses it on a regular basis. I think they're scared of it to a great extent, but on the other hand, why not? If you have a strain relief, you don't want to put the strain on the wires anyway, so you put them in some kind of IDC thing and you squish it down and they make a connection, and you could put a cable together in a few seconds. I mean, believe me, if I were on the road doing that kind of stuff, I would throw a bunch of those in my toolbox if you have to get it to work.
Story I heard was it was a union thing.
Oh, really?
A different union.
Yeah, because it's a data connector.
Could solder, and others could not solder.
Yeah.
And so the IDC connector was perfect for them because they could just mash it on.
Right.
Shall we break?
Yeah.
Sure. Great time.
Cookie break?
Cookie? Water?
Cookie break.
Body?
Wookie?
Whatever. Yeah, Wookie break? Sure. So let's reconvene at, 15 after?
Yeah.
And we'll do door prizes. Whoever didn't
sign in,
should
sign in.
Yeah, yes. Please sign in if you did.
Please sign in if you haven't. Water's, where's the water? Water's there, cookies are there.
Yes, indeed.
So you should see this in the door.